According to a recent federal survey, 14 million Americans use drugs, which means that they ingested some illegal drug during the previous month. Almost all of that drug use happens pretty secretly. Judith Kempfner has been thinking about a time when drug addiction was not so hidden or so well understood, when millions of people took opiates as part of dozens of over-the-counter elixirs. For a long time, the British in particular saw opium as exotic and romantic. Kempfner's own fascination began when she lived in Malaysia.
I took only two photos on my trip around the coast of Malaysia many years ago. One was of a pit of twisted snakes in a temple in Penang. They didn't turn out to be photogenic. The other was a photograph of a skeletal Chinese man with a leathery, expressionless face, smoking in an archway of the courtyard of an opium den. Behind him were other men, reclining or lolling alone on carved wooden benches. I felt a trespasser, that I should make myself invisible and hold my breath. I asked writer Barbara Hodson, who's delved long into the romantic side of opium, if my den was typical.
Opium dens have been described by a number of observers as filled with ghosts, a land where people aren't quite all there. Opium is romantic because of its exotic connections. So we have the whole history of opium smoking and the idea of the opium den that's built around it, lying around. You have to lie down to smoke opium. You have to take your time. And the effects are slow and accumulative. And so you can see that you could devote whole days to opium smoking practically.
I was an observer looking at the den from the perspective of a colonial heritage. It was as if the imperial days weren't over and the murky trade in opium, which the British promoted, still existed. Around the docks in London, there are still vestiges of the old wharves and warehouses. Think assassins and prostitutes. The recent movie, From Hell, about Jack the Ripper, had wonderful smoky scenes in a Chinese-owned opium den in London's East End. It could have come out of Oscar Wilde's The Portrait of Dorian Gray. Wilde's aristocratic hero enjoys slumming it down to the opium haunts, which, though not illegal, are tantalizingly illicit.
He heaved a deep breath and his nostrils quivered with pleasure. When he entered, a young man with smooth yellow hair who was bending over a lamp lighting a long, thin pipe looked up at him and nodded in a hesitating manner. "You here, Adrian?" muttered Dorian. "Where else should I be?" he answered listlessly. "None of the chaps will speak to me now." "I don't care," he added with a sigh. "As long as one has this stuff, one doesn't want friends. I think I've had too many friends." Dorian winced and looked round at the grotesque things that lay in such fantastic postures on the ragged mattresses. The twisted limbs, the gaping mouths, the staring, lusterless eyes fascinated him. He knew in what strange heavens they were suffering and what dull hells were teaching them the secret of some new joy.
The most famous Victorian British writing about opium is probably Thomas de Quincey's Confessions of an English Opium Eater. It has a wonderful title, but it's very rhetorical writing, almost as if it's being delivered in a law court. And then there's Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, Kubla Khan, a poem you're forced to learn, and so it becomes a piece of doggerel and is best lampooned.
In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a pleasure dome erect.
Much more fascinating is the way opium shaped the romantic imagination of John Keats. I grew up near the house where he had written Ode to a Nightingale. When I sat under the tree where he wrote, it felt like a sacred sight. Easy to feel how the drug made him feel as if he was up there, flying in the leafy canopy, having an out-of-body experience.
My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains. 1 minute passed, and Lethewood's had sunk.
Keats took opium to help him with the ravages of TB. He died in 1821, aged only 26. Since Keats had studied to be a doctor, Barbara Hodson says he was very aware of the physical effects of opium.
It shuts down certain parts of the body, so it shuts down the respiratory system, so your breathing slows down. It slows down your heart rate. It stops you from sweating. It stops the gastric process, so people who take opium tend to find themselves getting constipated.
Not romantic. Even at the height of the romance of opium in British culture, people looked past the ugly effects of opium. Even when I was in school in history class, when we learned about Godfrey's cordial, which parents gave to children to stop them crying, the teacher laughed. But it's not hard to find references to cordial babies becoming yellow and stunted and wizened like monkeys. Why didn't she tell us? I suspect for most Brits at least, opium is the Victorian drug, quaint. Heroin and morphine, which are derived from the same species of poppy, are much dirtier.
All the other patients say they've never seen a man with such face. Tell me, Sister Morphine, when are you coming round again?
That's all too graphic for me, too realistic. I want the remove. Opium is more enigmatic. I want the mysterious Oriental connections. I want the naivete. The Victorian writers weren't consciously adding to a confessional genre the way modern drug-induced artists do. There's a very private tension, most especially in this gem of an obscure poem by Arthur Symons. You get the image of the ravaged artist who can't give up his love for opium. I have this garret which I rent, this bed of straw, and this that was a chair, this worn-out body like a tattered tent, this crust of which the rats have eaten part, this pipe of opium, rage, remorse, despair, this soul at pawn, and this delirious heart. For Studio 360, I'm Judith Kempfner.